Is it?
You wouldn't know. Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, to keep up with our most recent happenings. We most recently discussed Alex Garland's film Annihilation. Before that was A Serious Man, the Coen Brothers film. Prior to that was Le Samurai, and prior to that was A Hard Day's Night. I've also written a couple things, one about The Savages and Juno, both movies from about 10 years ago, and one about The Post and Phantom Thread. So yeah, MacGuffinMen.com. Check those out.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little thrown off now. What are we talking about here today?
Oh, well, the official end of award season always comes with our Best Picture podcast.
Exactly, our Best Picture podcast a handful of days after people have stopped listening to podcasts about what won Best Picture. A tale as old as time.
So we're going to talk about Shape of Water, which won Best Picture, and I think some general Oscar stuff. I don't know how. Where do you want to start?
Oh yeah, yeah. I guess I didn't mention this to you. We should talk about The Shape of Water as a movie, and then talk about all the Oscar stuff afterwards.
Okay, because, deal.
Yeah, I think in respect to cinema in general, I feel like we should always put movies first, as opposed to
okay.
Awards, statues, and whatnot.
Fair.
Yeah,
that's a great stance.
I have one principle, and that is it. Everything else is out the window. So I'm curious to know what you think about this movie, just in general.
Oh, yeah, we haven't really talked about it at all. No, I think it is I think it's a movie clearly made by someone who is a professional film director, mm-hmm. which Guillermo del Toro is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, otherwise, when it was done, I was like, all right, that's the Shape of Water, I guess. Yeah. I think it's kind of what I expected. There was a couple surprises. And as I said, this is not, you know, that makes it sound like I really wasn't impressed with this movie. I think that it was the craft of it is, you know, everything's in the right place. And other than that, it's just, yeah, it's a fine movie.
Yeah, no, I basically agree with you.
I was trying to predict your feelings on this too after I watched it, and I thought this would be one we more or less agreed with.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm not the biggest Guillermo del Toro fan, traditionally. I think, like, the only movie of his that I like is Pan's Labyrinth. I haven't seen all of them, but as far as his work since I've started to, I guess since the year 2000, I've probably seen everything he's done. Pan's Labyrinth is the only movie I remember even really liking, and I have such a strong hatred for Pacific Rim, and maybe even stronger hatred for Crimson Peak. I hated both those movies so much, but this is a good movie. And I what you're talking about, I think, is something that has been like a real I don't know what to call affliction is like too negative of a word, but something that has just sort of happened in that over the past handful of years, 3.5-star movies have sort of become 5-star movies because of Rotten Tomatoes, you know, and just sort of like a positive review. It's either 0 stars or 5 stars. You know, you're the emoji movie or you're Lady Bird and you've got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
And again, like criticism just doesn't work as a binary. And this is something that to me is a 3.5-star movie. I really enjoyed watching it. I saw it in theaters probably in January. I was like surprisingly late to it, given that I did actually want to see it. And it's a movie that Michael Shannon is in. I remember walking out of it being like, yeah, that was good. I like that. I might see that again. But it wasn't like something that I just sort of felt compelled to watch again. And like you said, very capably made movie. I have like some issues with the way things are done, but also when you sort of take into consideration the budget that the crew is working with on this movie, what they pulled off is pretty amazing. So I think that sort of speaks to a level of skill that Del Toro has, this a level of skill that I've never doubted. I've more just had problems with his storytelling, and this is a movie where most of his problems are kind of washed away in that regard. But yeah, a very good movie, and I very much enjoyed watching it. But it was not something that I don't think either of us would have felt compelled to podcast about, you know? And it's why we're also talking about other topics in the second half of this podcast, because I feel like we will have time, you know?
Yeah, I think it's... I'm just going to have to keep asserting that. You said it was very capably made. I think this is a very polished movie without being super stylized. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem like a movie that, oh, we'll figure this out in editing or something. Like, mm-hmm. even especially in just the transitions of scenes, you know, the order of the scenes is so meaningful in the way that, you know, dialogue that finishes one scene is important to the opening of the next scene. You know, this is a crafted film. This is one that, you know, clearly he had kicked around his head for a while, had a pretty good idea, him and, you know, other people involved in making this movie, because it doesn't just take one person. But it seems like a very fully realized movie. And I think it probably ended up looking exactly the way he wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. And that just wasn't a movie that was ever going to blow my socks off. And he's a very talented guy. He seems like a nice, cool guy too.
He's such a legitimately cool human being. Like,
yeah,
he's on the list of people that I'm really worried will find out that he's secretly homophobic or something, you know, like, just along the lines, just because he just seems like such a good, like enjoyable human being, you know. And every year I see him around TIFF, and he's always just like, people come up to talk to him, and he's just like so genuinely happy to talk to fans. I don't know, I always, that you don't see that in a lot of people, and it's cool, you know.
Yeah, and I have nothing, there's not a ton I can say really bad about this movie other than meh. I don't have a ton of negative stuff about it. And I read a quote from him that said, talking about The Shape of Water, saying, "This movie is a healing movie for me. For 9 movies, I rephrase the fears of my childhood, the dreams of my childhood, and this is the first time I speak as an adult about something that worries me as an adult. I speak about trust, otherness, sex, love, where we're going. These are not concerns that I had when I was 9 or 7. And I just think that's illuminating in the sense that this is kind of a science fiction movie, you know, in that there is something supernatural going on, and you know, we have kind of the scrappy rebels and the you know, the authoritarian figure trying to put an end to their affection, which is very broadly a common science fiction thing, but it's not really a genre movie that much.
It's kind of a lot of genre movies just at the same time, I think, is a good
right,
way to
okay.
put it. Don't you agree?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. I was reading an article about how, you know, this and Get Out kind of making a case for genre movies getting critical reception. And you and I both like to Get Out. And yeah, that, you know, it was a horror movie in a certain way, and this is a science fiction movie in a certain way. But this is, as you said, kind of a mishmash of so many things that you lose a bit of it in the wash, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think calling it a genre movie is 100% correct. I think specifying the genre as science fiction is not, you know, because there's a lot of,
yeah.
I mean, I think in both of his acceptance speeches on Sunday, he mentioned Douglas Sirk, and it's very much like old fashioned Douglas Sirk sort of melodramatic romance. Like this movie actually really reminds me of the Todd Haynes film Far From Heaven, which was sort of like a tribute to all these old romance movies, specifically Douglas Sirk directed movies that came out in the early 2000s. And what it added was like, elements of, like, there's a gay character in that movie, which is something that would have been totally ignored. And in the time that Sirk was making movies, and what The Shape of Water does is like triple down on that and add like all these different types of characters that would have been totally ignored in that type of movie, you know?
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, the reason I even read that quote is that I just, it very much seems like that's what this was. And I'm not, you know, a huge fan or expert of what his career has been up to this point. Mm-hmm. But I love that idea that he's worked on his craft for all this time. He's kind of grown up in a way, and he's making something as an adult for adults. And, you know, that's admirable. And I think that's the kind of filmmaking you and I are always asking for. And this one, just similar to Annihilation, like I think I see the movie that I want this to be, and it's not quite that.
Okay. I will say, I assume you did not see this in a movie theater, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
I tried to, got sick.
No, anyway. I'm not shaming you. This is not movie theater shaming. You also live in a city where it's a lot harder to see some of these movies than it is for me. But I will say this is a fantastic movie to see in a theater. I saw it like a 7 p.m. Wednesday screening, and it's really fun because there are like moments that you forget about as time passes, and it's been a week since you've seen the movie, and you're talking to a friend, and you're like, oh yeah, I guess the amphibian man did bite the head off a cat, you know, like things like that are great. Michael Shannon and his fingers, all of that stuff is like you can feel that in the audience. It's really weird. The sex scene he has with his wife is really like uncomfortable. And the musical sequence, you can feel the audience be like, what is happening? You know? And that's something that I strongly, strongly appreciate about this movie. And I mean, we mentioned Baby Driver already. When I say we, I mean, I mentioned Baby Driver already. Don't mean to speak for both of us, but like that was another movie that I found was just so helped so much by seeing it in a theater and feeling the amount of fun that other people were having in certain moments. And I think that type of movie is something I will always appreciate. Something that is a good movie that is made with adults in mind that also plays specifically for a theatrical experience, you know?
Yeah. And similar to Annihilation again, I love that it was willing to do unexpected things like the musical number. There's sort of a cardinal rule in cinema that you don't kill the dog or the cat. And I mean, I have more affection for a cat than you do in general, but I love that they are willing to break those rules and do something that's so irreverent and so shocking. And it's nice to see them kind of swing for the fences like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so you talked about the musical number, and you know, we get a bit of that piece by piece. You know, we see them watching some musicals together and kind of dancing a little bit. And she introduces, what are we calling her love interest in this?
He's credited as Amphibian Man. I'll take basically anything. You know, you can call him Fishman. Anything related to something.
You won't be confused with Richard Jenkins or Michael Shannon.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so we have her introducing Amphibian Man to music and dance, her dancing, and that kind of overwhelms the movie at the point that the big musical number happens. And
it's really late in the movie. I think there's maybe 25 minutes left. You know?
Yes, it's very late. Again, very late to do something big like that. That got me thinking about this as a movie about movies. And as I said, we kind of get it sprinkled early on, and then, you know, and she lives above a movie theater, and when the bathroom is being flooded, you kind of get the sense that the floor might collapse, and, you know, she falls into this movie theater, and that there's this very stylized, romanticized kind of love that's on the screen. It's something that they're going to, you know, literally fall into in a way, and that they achieve this love that's you know, seemingly too good to be true. This thing from the past that's very, very, very clean and wholesome, and just a great form of love. And I want to know, you tend to see the movie about movie thing more readily than I do. And I picked up on it here. I just want to know what you thought about it.
I think it's something that I like that it doesn't blind. I think it can feel like from afar that it blindly romanticizes movies, but I don't think that is true of the movie when you actually sort of think about it. I don't know how I feel about this as a movie about movies. I don't feel like it's about movies. I feel like it's about people who watch a lot of movies. And I think there's a difference there. You know, like, I think La La Land, say, to use a recent example, is more of a movie about the movies than it is about, say, Seb's influence of those movies influencing him. You know, this movie, I feel like Giles is somebody whose life has been strongly influenced by those movies, and to a lesser extent Eliza's as well, just by being friends with Giles. And I think one of the key moments for all of that cinema stuff that plays into the movie is that everybody's sort of drawn to these images, right? Like, even Amphibian Man, you know, when he escapes the apartment, he goes downstairs to the Elgin Theater, you know, like, and he's just standing there watching a movie. And which I will say is a fantastic movie theater to see a movie in.
Yeah.
I understand the appeal. But he's sort of drawn to it. And Giles always seems to be wanting to watch these things. And Eliza never really, outside of the dance sequence, never herself really seems to be drawn to the movies. But I think the key is with Giles, there's that scene where Eliza's either flipping around TV or a news report comes on TV, and it's footage of, you know, people fighting for civil rights. And Giles immediately is like, turn that channel, or change the channel. We don't want to watch this. And so I think that's supposed to convey the idea of
the bad kind of escapism.
Yeah, like ignoring realities to sort of ignoring realities and covering them up with pleasantries, you know, because there's a lot of, you know, they seem to, in this movie, there seem to be pretty whimsical films almost entirely. I think Shirley Temple's in one of them, you know, and it's that type of entertainment that they're watching. You know, it's not necessarily mindfully enriching. It's just sort of, it's escapism. It can be very well done escapism, but it doesn't seem to be necessarily enriching the mind. And I think that's meant to show that Giles is just trying to cover up certain aspects of his own life. Like, he's trying to deny certain things about reality, just like by watching any of these old classical movies. You, even now, like, when you think back to 50 years ago or whatever, 60 years ago, Humphrey Bogart was wasted in a bar every night. You know, like, there, that image we have of him as this, like, suave sort of tough guy didn't exist all the time. He was passed out and vomiting on himself 3 a.m. every night, you know? And yeah. And I think that's sort of what the use of movies is meant to show in this, in The Shape of Water, is that at some point you have to be able to leave those behind and start to embrace realities of the world, you know, even in this unreal version of the world that we are watching.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about it that way. And I forget the actress that they're speaking about, but they kind of speak about her in a very real sense, that, you know, she's glamorous and kind of, you know, seemingly had it all, and a lot of people would be jealous to have her spot, but she was so unhappy with you know, the working conditions and the people she had to deal with and the phoniness, that she walked away from it. So something that can seem so glamorous and enviable on screen, the true lived experience is something that's worth walking away from to this woman.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And even, like, just to sort of touch on Eliza's relationship to movies, you know, she doesn't seem to have a television of her own. She just watches with Giles. And there's, I don't know if this is consistent throughout the whole film, but there's definitely one shot in the movie where her and Giles are standing in the hallway. And there are film reels outside of Eliza's apartment. And she's the person that takes the most action in this movie. And she has, you know, it's because there's a movie theater downstairs. They've got to keep the 35mm roll somewhere, or reel somewhere. Makes sense that, you know, just be like, all right, keep them upstairs. But it just sort of signifies that there are, she's close to movies, but she keeps them outside of her world still, you know, whereas Giles very much invites them inside of his world. And I think that's the main difference between them. And the key line of the movie is Eliza saying to Giles, if we do nothing, we are nothing. And Giles has spent a lot of time doing nothing. And I think he sort of starts to realize that, you know, and immediately after that, after that line, it's like almost too on the nose. We get two consecutive scenes of him finding out realities of the world as him going to the advertising agency guy for the second time and being shut down. And then immediately after that, he goes for pie and finds out that the guy from Ottawa is a racist homophobe.
yeah.
So it's like those things that jar him into action. It's those things that make him realize the realities of the world. And I think that's the key difference between them, even though we're meant to see them as so close, and the way their apartment hallway is designed is also meant to show that they are similar. But Eliza keeps the film just outside of her door. Like she keeps some dividers, you know?
Yeah. And to speak of Giles, let's say tenuous connection of reality. You mentioned that scene where he goes to his boss, I guess.
Former boss, it seems like, yeah.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Well, definitely former something.
Yeah, for the second time. And also he speaks about it with the unlikable man at the pie store. Well, the eventually unlikable man at the pie store.
Yeah.
What Giles is peddling is this this artistic rendering of reality, and he finds that he can't do as well as a picture. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is him constructing reality, you know, something that doesn't exist, and kind of hitting coming up against the actual reality, right? Mm-hmm. Like he draws these very Norman Rockwell Americana, you know, very sweet, innocent, wholesome pictures, and that he has this very fanciful view of how the world works, and it's not registering with other people, right? Like it's unwanted. He does live in this place that doesn't seem to exist, and mm-hmm. that comes through in, you know, the way his art turns out, and as you said, just watching these movies and not really engaging with reality. And he has some reasons, you know, he can't engage with the reality of who he really is because mm-hmm. of where and when he lives. So it's, you know, there's a sympathetic angle to it too, but there's a lot of ways that illustrate his lack of desire or his inability to connect with the real world. And what we see with the people around him is people who are more attached to reality. And as you said, more proactive and able to, you know, the first thing Eliza does, you know, is to recognize the reality of the situation, and then she can act within that.
Yeah, exactly. And just as a point to tie into that, candy and sweets are a motif throughout the movie as well. Most obviously, Michael Shannon's character Strickland is just constantly chomping on these candies. The guy that provides Eliza and Giles with their pie turns out to be somebody that we do not care for as a human being. I mean, I suppose assuming the viewer is not a racist or a homophobe or both. Yeah. And if Giles could tell his younger self one, or I suppose two things, he would say fuck more, but it also take better care of your teeth. And I think all those things are meant to sort of mind how much of the sugary pleasantries of life that you are partaking in, and you can't subsist entirely on those things, you know?
Right. And one more thing about his the time period of the movies that he's watching, these are often shown as these things that are, as I said, kind of very glitzy and on the surface can be very wholesome, and just the nature of the musicals of that time, there are these gigantic spectacles that they're so fun to watch and they're so extravagant, and you know, you watch these big musical dance numbers and it's so pleasing to the eye, and you know, that's the candy, and the reality is that, you know, you had a director yelling and you know, sexually harassing all these scantily clad women in these dance numbers to make this final product, and that's the tooth rot that Giles is dealing with, right? Like it's the downside of all of what goes into making that surface shine.
Exactly, and that's not to say that there are no positive aspects to to watching these movies. And that's what the dance sequence is meant to signify, is that as the color drains out and we go sort of black and white, and Eliza gains a voice to be able to sing for that number, you know, it gives her an escape from her world. It makes her feel like she has something that she can't have in reality. She can't have a voice, so she has it in this dream, but she loses the color, right? So it's this, it's a sequence meant to signify that, like, you can live in this made-up reality in your head if you want, and you can have everything you want in there, but it's just not, like, you don't get all the colors of real life in it. And that's something that I think the movie does a really, really good job of signifying, is that these things are wonderful, but these things all the time are not wonderful. You know, you have to also do something, you know?
Yeah, and we learn that in the pie shop again. Like, it's... he's from Ottawa. He's not the southern farm boy that he plays, right? And yeah, just touching on this idea that there is this idealized past that everybody kind of wants to go back to. You know, in the 60s, they wanted it to be the 40s. You know, there's always this kind of this backward-looking thing. And yeah, and you can look back on something with rose-colored glasses, and it was also great then, and then a black couple walks into the restaurant, yeah, yeah. And you see that, yeah, this wasn't great for a lot of people. And, yeah, like that distance allows you certain things, but, as you said, you lose the color, you lose the nuance, you definitely, that distance shrouds your understanding of the true nature of these situations for everybody involved.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And Michael Shannon says foo-foo.
Yeah, I mean, is this the part of the podcast where we just talk about Michael Shannon for a couple minutes and how he's spectacular and everything? I don't know.
Yeah, I think so.
I feel like we're retreading. We're retreading, yeah. But it's just, it's such a fun tread, you know?
Yeah, okay, so he's perfect for roles like this. I mean, I don't know what he's not good at yet. I'll tell you when I find out, but... yeah, very entertaining. And this one, I mean, I'm sure we'll get to this in a bit. He is a very over-the-top character. He's kind of there to do one thing with very little nuance. We're not supposed to really sympathize with him. You know, we talked about Philip Seymour Hoffman being able to inject, you know, some sympathy into these kind of unlikable characters. Michael Shannon, I don't think you sympathize with him, but he does seem to make these pretty one-dimensional characters still more dynamic. They're not likable, but there is something very real and three-dimensional about what is such a cartoon cutout of a authoritarian baddie in a movie, right?
Yeah, I think I take mild quarry with your use of the term real. I don't feel like there's anything that feels like real about Michael Shannon, but you are right that he adds three dimensions. Absolutely. Like,
okay.
And there is something sort of that we can't quite explain with words that he is able to bring to roles like this, where, you know, it's just that indescribable thing about great acting is that you can't quite describe what is being done, but you just know that you can point to it and be like, this is good. And the person you are showing that to is like, oh yeah, obviously, you don't need to point, you know, like,
yeah.
I don't know. There's just something about him that's just so watchable and you absolutely unique. And, you never really know what he's going to do. And despite the fact that we've seen him play this type of character before, you never quite know how he's going to play it. And there's just something, his characters do really feel alive, even when we're seeing him play the type of character we've seen him play before. Yeah.
Yeah. And, to speak again about this, just being a well-made movie, the good direction. And I mean, I'll keep saying it's not just one person, because the direction of this movie is very good, but I think that visually there's a lot of things to like in this movie, and that's not just a director's job. Mm-hmm. And when I said earlier that it's fully realized, like, I just think that this has a color palette and good sets. And as you said, there's not a ton of money in here, and it just all looks very good. Like, I it never feels cheap or lazy. It's just a world you kind of step into and you live in for whatever 2 hours and then you get out of. But it does seem very very fully realized. And when you have all those things going on and you can put a good performance in it and they just complement each other so well. And when Michael Shannon puts his wedding ring back on his finger, like just kind of snatches it out of the air when they're talking at his desk or something, like it's such a small thing. And it's just he did it, or they let him do it, or they told him to do it. And it's such a small, stupid thing, but stuff like that, when put together with all the, you know, much trickier, bigger things, and you know, they just use one angle for that. And he just snatches it back on, and it's not
a
plot point.
Sound too,
yeah,
right?
Like, it's so unimportant that if it wasn't there, this movie wouldn't feel like it was missing something. But yeah, just good actors and good filmmakers can just inject those little things in that just they just keep you interested, and they just flesh out the world well.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you're saying about...
And I'm using that as more of an example of there's 100 things like that, right?
Yeah.
But that's one that I can remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you're saying about, you know, the production design being so important in this movie, that's correct. And film is a collaborative medium. I feel like we've said this a lot over the past year, that the auteur theory is something that we sort of subscribe to, just in a way of making it way easier to talk about movies when we just sort of ascribe everything to the director. And it's not really true. It just makes criticism easier, so we do it. But still, like, Guillermo del Toro is a type of director that cares about production design more than most directors, you know? But that is not to say the production designer's role isn't important on every film. It's just that it's more notable in something like this because Guillermo del Toro makes it a focus, you know? And it's something that he actually wants to stylize, whereas somebody like Christopher Nolan, like his whole thing is just don't distract the viewer from the story, you know? And so his production designer, I believe, like, their mandate is just like make it look good, but don't make it distracting good, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas we're talking like this is a stylized movie. It's been described as a fairy tale by more than one person, by more than 10,000 people. And so it's sort of just it just works for this movie to be very production design heavy, because nothing about it looks real. Like even those shots of the Orpheum Theater, the exterior, which is like the most prominent exterior shot we get in the movie in any sort of like large space. Pretty much everything else exterior is out by the water. It's even then it's still just, it never feels like reality, you know?
No, every room feels huge.
yeah, absolutely. And I mean, right off the bat, we get that the opening shot of this movie is the best shot in the movie. It's the where we're going through Eliza's apartment, and it's just filled with water as she's asleep during the opening credits. And it's an awesome shot, and never for a second do you feel like you are looking at reality.
Yeah.
But you're like, coming... holy shit, this is beautiful, and this is why I see movies.
Yeah, and coming from a director who has done things that are, you know, more science fiction than this, there's just a lot more decisions to be made about production design and world building when you're not making a, you know, a little indie drama about a couple, right? Mm-hmm. The production design is just a lot more important to these movies that are in the future or in a supernatural place, you know? So just the idea of having to create a lot different worlds, it's such a mental task. And this is, you know, it's Baltimore, it's a place that we know, but it's the 60s, and it's, as you said, it's still a fairy tale. It's not meant to provide a perfect reflection of reality, so that's why it never feels like that, as you said, which I think is accurate.
Yeah, it's Baltimore in the 60s, and we see maybe one square block of outside, you know, like
right.
So yeah, there's just not a lot to tie it to any sort of reality, just because we don't, as you said, leave sets very frequently. And while we're talking about direction, I think it's as good a time as I need to point out the things that Guillermo del Toro does really well. And one of the things that I find he does is he's patient in the way that he'll do those sort of like medium length oners that Spielberg is famous for. Not to the level that Spielberg does, because nobody can do what Spielberg can do with a camera. And but like stuff like the first shot where we see Michael Shannon enter the movie, it's about a 45-50 second Steadicam shot, and there's a bunch of different framings throughout it, and it's when Amphibian Man gets rolled in. Before that, we see Octavia Spencer's character, whose name is escaping me, and Eliza sort of cleaning.
Zelda,
yes. We see them cleaning and talking to people, and I believe Dimitri makes an appearance, and then we go to the doors as Amphibian Man rolls in, and then Michael Shannon walks in, and it's just this really well-designed shot. It plays out in about 45-50 seconds, and there's a bunch of different framings contained within that, where and that's a style I really like, as opposed to just having separate shots that you then piece together in editing. And there are lots of examples of that happening throughout this movie, not necessarily to that length, but I would imagine the average shot length of this movie is definitely below the average American film. And I'll always appreciate that. Another really good example of that is in the car dealership, where we get one sort of establishing shot of Michael Shannon looking into a car, and then we cut to a wide shot, and the rest of the scene plays out in that shot, which is about another 50 seconds. Yeah.
No, I'm just laughing about the Cadillac.
Yeah.
Showroom.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's it's good set design. The guy that plays the car dealer is great. Like, he's in the movie for literally one shot, and he is so good.
Yeah. No, I think of that scene, it's, hey, let's be dicks. We're both rich dudes in the 60s. I agree. And just to speak about Michael Shannon's character again, because you bring up that Cadillac sequence again. I mean, he does... This character is one that we've seen before in a lot of ways. He kind of hits a lot of the, cold, uncaring person, like suburban man checklist, right? Mm-hmm. Like he's buying the Cadillac, like wanting the newest car. And his wife is introducing, this new gelatin thing. You know, there's this idea, keeping up with the Joneses and conspicuous consumption, that they are the perfect little nuclear family. And
I mean, he literally says this is America at one point. Yeah. When he's sitting at home.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I want to talk about. Like it's a character who's seen a million times. I mean, just this, like, so we have his family, and let's compare that to, you know, the closest thing that we see as a family, or the other relationships we get any good look at throughout this movie. Eliza lives with her closeted gay neighbor, spends a lot of time with, a visible minority, Zelda. It's so different than where we're positioning, Michael Shannon, Strickland, and his family. And that's there is a bit of nuance to his character, which I think we should get to, but I think this is what you and I kind of both talk about when we say, like, yeah, that was Shape of Water. Like it's kind of, I know how you feel about Revolutionary Road. Like it's so much of that kind of checklist stuff that we've seen before. The wife obsessed with cleanliness, Strickland obsessed with silence, that weird, uncomfortable sex scene that you've talked about where he's like, fetishizing silence and control over a woman.
And bleeding on her face.
It's all so gross and uncomfortable. And that little bit kind of makes it still, like that little bit more makes it still effective and having this emotional impact, I think, on the viewer.
He's also the only character in the movie that ever really mentions religion, and he talks about it relatively frequently. I can't recall if you've mentioned that or not.
No, I have.
Yeah, but and the car dealership, the car dealer says to him, "You're a man of the future. You need this car." In that scene, when in reality he's a man of the past. You know, like everything we've described is something. And the movie's so clearly trying to point us to him being representative of the past, not the future. And you know, he sticks to the, I mean, one of my favorite moments in this movie is towards the end when he talks about why he keeps eating that same cheap candy. It's the candy he always liked. So if you take any of that shit like nougat around him, he's going to be upset, that fancy stuff. You know, he loves God, as you said. He wants to be submissive, or sorry, he wants women to be submissive and silent. And I think something that sort of sums it all up is that, like, there's that scene where Eliza signs to him "fuck you," and then sort of covers it up by saying thank you. Her and Zelda cover it up as a team, but the whole thing is that, like, this quote-unquote man of the future slash in reality man of the past can't understand what a different kind of voice is trying to say to him, and he looks foolish because of it, you know. It's just by not accepting people outside of himself, he's the monster of the movie. It's very clearly alluded to in the opening narration of the film. And I think that's just what he's meant to stand out for. He is not the most subtle point of this movie. And I think if this character is played by somebody other than Michael Shannon, I think it's a huge, it would immediately become a pretty big detriment to this movie.
There's
like a small handful of people. I mean, I can't imagine anybody playing it like him. I could imagine somebody having a good take on it that's different, but not a lot of people. You know, I feel like Michael Shannon's so important in this movie. In the same way, I mean, I don't even think we've mentioned her name. Sally Hawkins is fucking amazing in this movie.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned
She's
Sally.
So good. Yeah. And, yeah, and she is so important to this movie, and I can't say I've seen her in a lot of movies, but the movies I have seen her in, I think it was Happy Go Lucky, the Mike Leigh movie, which I think she also got nominated for an Oscar for about 8-9 years ago, and she's fantastic in that, and like every time you see her in something, she's great, and both of those actors I think are so important to the movie, but maybe even more so Michael Shannon, just in the way that he is able to sort of play a character that's so on the nose in a way that sort of distracts you from how on the nose he is. Just by being Michael Shannon.
Yeah, let's. I'll finish up with Michael Shannon. We'll talk more about Sally Hawkins for sure, because I mean, if you dislike Sally Hawkins, I have several questions for you. And yeah. Obviously, you she's so integral to this movie that you did not like this movie if you did not like her, I would imagine. Yeah, and I thought that even there, the Strickland, well, I guess the Strickland family, I thought it was interesting that they watch Bonanza, they watch 50s television or 50s, 60s television. You know, they watch this contemporary violent TV, whereas Eliza and Giles are more aligned. You know, they're still watching a television, but they're watching movies from 20, 30 years before, right? Mm-hmm. Like it all seems, you know, very distant to us now because it was so long ago. But you know, that's like the Strickland family watching Transformers or like playing Grand Theft Auto or something, right? Like it is the kind of the low hanging fruit, the you know, candy for the mind that a suburban family watching television, you know, that's the equivalent. And we have the characters that we're supposed to align with watching something that's more wholesome and pleasant.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Sally Hawkins is awesome in this movie. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, she is. I don't know what to say either. I mean, we'll, one more kind of juxtaposition between her and Strickland is, you know, he's got the new car that he rides by himself, and she rides the bus.
Yep.
You know, she's someone who's with the people. I mean, I'm sure it's more of a fact that she probably can't afford a brand new Cadillac, but this is one more way that they put him as this solitary person who wants to be placed above people where she is. She's in the community, even if she cuts in line at work every day, which is not very lovable behavior, Eliza, but yeah, when Sally Hawkins does it, it's okay.
Yeah. I can't believe I missed a public transit metaphor. I'm usually all over those ones.
Yeah, there you go.
That's kind of my jam. but yeah, she's fantastic. And I think in talking about this movie, I said at the top that it's like a 3.5-star movie. I don't know. I think in talking about this movie, it's a 4-star movie to me now.
Okay. I'm found half a
designation. I don't know.
My bus metaphor bought half a star.
No. Just the conversation in general. I would never give you that credit.
Yeah. Another thing that I think they do, the things that we were saying, like right up front about this movie, is stuff like this, like it is layered. They have these visual metaphors. They have, you know, you said that Strickland could kind of be too much if it were played by somebody else. I think a lot of this stuff could be kind of heavy-handed or forced down your throat if it wasn't done as well as it is. And I don't think that this is super nuanced and super layered all the way through, but it does a lot of these things that we would roll our eyes at if it were handled with, with less grace. And I think that it is a 3.5 to perhaps 4-star movie because it doesn't fall into all those pits. And Eliza, even something just the way that she boils the eggs and makes the eggs, and you know, it's another visual thing that we see kind of laced through this movie, which that repetition without getting stale, I think, is something that, when I say a movie has a complete vision or is obviously well thought out, it's stuff like that where we have these leitmotifs, we have these things that show up and stay and maintain meaning or gain meaning, but without being, you know, without hitting us over the head with it. And just like the bus, I think that the eggs kind of represent a nicer, like it's very rural, very farm, very community oriented, unlike the sugary confection wrapped in garbage that is the candy that we see Strickland eating, right? Mm-hmm. And we see her kind of make her in with the amphibian man through this thing. And just the egg, what it is, you know, it's a symbol of youth and motherhood and community and family and just all these very pleasant things, and they don't spell it out for you. And if you don't pick up on any of that, it's fine. And, but there are these meanings there that, give these very kind of these very pleasant and, positive tones to what the relationship that we're supposed to be cheering for is developing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Oh, we should talk more about Dimitri too. Speaking of,
I know. I just don't really have anything to say about him. I don't know. He's the person in this movie that feels the most like a character that just sort of is here to help the plot along, you know?
Yeah. So what do you make of him being a Soviet spy that we are meant to not dislike in a movie set in the Cold War during that investigation into Russian treason?
I think maybe it's along the lines of why we're immediately supposed to empathize with empathize with Amphibian Man. It's that from afar this amphibian man is supposed to look like a monster to us, but when we get to know him as the movie shows us, even in the guise of a monster, there can be a human, basically. Yeah, or something that you can connect with as a human in the case of Amphibian Man.
Yeah, and I don't know if his motivations are entirely clear, but he wants to keep Amphibian Man alive.
Yes, Dimitri. Yeah, it's mostly like just for the nature of continuing scientific research, basically, is where he seems to at least vocalize where he's coming from. And then there also seems to be an empathy in him as well. Because he might murder somebody. I forget if that was a tranquilizer that he sticks in the dude's neck or if he kills him. But the security guard that's not going to let Giles in when they're doing the big heist. But yeah, he may or may not kill somebody in this movie. I just can't recall.
Yeah, and just the idea that because you're born in Russia, you know, it's not the it's not by the dint of the circumstance of where you're born or what you look like or something like that, but the actions that you take. And we don't really see him take bad actions in this movie, which I think is why we're left to still view him as a positive actor in this.
Yep. That makes sense. I don't know. Do you have any more thoughts? I feel like a Russian spy in the Cold War is more your wheelhouse than mine.
No, it is. I honestly didn't know that Michael Stuhlbarg was in this movie.
He was in a full third of Best Picture nominees this year.
Oh, good for him.
He's also in The Post looking very ill. Steven Spielberg, Janusz Kaminski, color palette did not treat his complexion well at all. I felt bad for
him. Speaking of color palette, do you want to talk about the greenest movie since The Matrix? Color palette?
I mean, yeah, I don't really have much to say other than, like, everything is green, and then at the end we get Eliza in a red coat, you know, and it's supposed to sort of show that, and you know, as the film progresses, like she seems to be wearing a lot of grays towards the beginning. I think there's green involved in her outfit. I mean, I'm sure there's green involved in her outfit because there's green involved in everything in this movie for work. And, you know, in the last shot of the movie, I mean, it's also the poster of the movie, so it's hard to miss, is she's wearing a big red coat. And I think that that's meant to stand in contrast to the green that represents Amphibian Man, and just to sort of represent that, despite being two very different looking colors, looking people, whatever, they come together and are able to find a commonality between them, you know, or many commonalities between them.
Yes. Yeah, and I there's green almost everywhere. The Strickland home is very devoid of green. And I think that we get, you know, him between his brand new car and his wife's obsession. Like, she's always cleaning and the house is always, it's very white and bright, and, you know, kind of sanitized. And yeah, the rest of this movie, especially Eliza and obviously Amphibian Man, there's this kind of this green, like there's a griminess, like sort of a lived in kind of darker, more of like a communal space, like somewhere that someone's actually been, other than these, I mean, rather than these really, you know, very squeaky clean, shiny areas like Strickland's home. And I think that that just goes to show the, you know, what we were talking about before, to get away from that confection, to get away from the surface, the glitz and glamour of Hollywood, or anything that is essentially too good to be true, that there is another way to do things, and that's a way that involves people and culture and things existing, and sort of more of the, you know, it might be rough around the edges, it might, you know, there might be some dirt involved, but it's a true representation of what life is, or what it should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you feel like you have anything further to add about the film?
No, I don't think so. I think we can move on to, I mean, we'll probably come back and forth talking about
for sure.
Oscars.
Yeah. I mean, this movie won 4 of them. Production design,
which I have no problem with.
Yeah, no, of course. Director.
I will not demand that Oscar back.
Best Picture and... Oh, and the one I will demand back, Best Score.
Oh, yes. Air your grievances now. Or your one grievance.
I mean, Supermarine. Listen to the Supermarine on the Dunkirk score and tell me that's not the best cue of the year. Like... Are you insane? It's crazy. Like, even by Hans Zimmer standards, it's absurdly good. And say what you want about the rest of the score, but just that one piece of music should be rewarded. Johnny Greenwood knocked it out of the park on Phantom Thread. Not surprising.
Surprise, yeah.
And, like, I mean, I liked Carter Burwell's score in the Three Billboards better than I liked Alexander Desplat's for The Shape of Water, but that's also just... It's a very Carter Burwell-y score. It's not like he's rewriting his own formula or anything in the way that I felt like Johnny Greenwood and Hans Zimmer did.
Yeah, he's like, oh, a movie set in Missouri with poor people?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Starring Frances McDormand? I think I can handle this.
I can do this.
Yeah. You know, and I just sort of like his style more, whereas Alexander Desplat, like his style is just very... very classical, and it's why it fits the movie. It's just like, and the score does fit the movie, but I just, as the best score of the year, just that one actually made me kind of upset. I try and remove myself as much as possible from caring about these awards, but I find every year, if something that I don't want to win wins best director, best score, or best cinematography, I do still get upset. I can't avoid it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was one of them this year.
Oh, that's too bad.
But yeah, speaking about best director, I was not rooting for Guillermo del Toro.
I mean, it's hard to hate, though. You know what I mean? I think we've both landed on, hey, you, you did a great job of making something I didn't ask for.
Yep.
Like, I think, you know, I don't know how to put it differently other than, you had an idea in your head, and I think you perfectly translated it to, well, not celluloid, but onto the screen. And it feels, and I'll say this for, I think, the fourth time, just fully realized and a complete vision of something. And that has merit.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I just feel like there are people I would rather have had this award, you know? And so I guess the question is, like, the thing that I've been thinking about a lot over, like, in this award season is I've sort of started to think about the people that didn't win awards and sort of how that affects their career, as well as how winning an award actually affects either these people's career or this movie, how we talk about this movie. And so I think the best way in for this conversation is, like, Guillermo del Toro won Best Director, so it's sort of like, it validates a lot of things a lot of film nerds have been saying for a long time. You know, it's that people, since I remember since, like, Blade 2 came out, and people were, like, he had been sort of, Guillermo del Toro had been, like, up and comer. He had done
Director Blade 2, yeah.
Well, no, but he had done some movies that were widely regarded as good by film critics, but were just sort of unseen. Kronos, I think, is the big one of those. Maybe Devil's Backbone. I forget if that came before or after Blade 2. But then Blade 2, it was like, okay, now he's taking these tools to Hollywood. And so when you look back in reviews of Blade 2, you can feel film critics trying to, like, politely explain to people that are going to see Blade 2 that this guy is not, like, just a superhero movie director, you know, like, he has a career before it, sort of thing, a career that's worth checking out. And that continues throughout Hellboy, the two Hellboy movies, and now we just sort of get to, and Pan's Labyrinth was widely regarded as a good film when it came out, and is still, I mean, up until, I think, Sunday Night was his most famous film. but now we sort of they have, like, a gold statuette that they can point to as, like, yes, we were right when we were talking about Blade 2. And he was sort of, due to Hellboy's sort of niche appreciation in comics, and also just the way that people that care about monster movies or monster characters like to support things that do monsters well, he sort of has those, like, those areas of people that have always been on his side. And this is sort of a way, a time when, you know, the masses at least understand who he is and what he does now, you know,
which, yeah, like, a bit of
always been the case,
a bit of, like, Joss Whedon, right?
Yes. Like, yeah. Joss Whedon's a good comparison point.
Yeah. Like, it's a vampire show. No, it's a teenage female show. Like, it's, he's very adept at living in those worlds, but is achieving things that a normal, you know, B movie that has all those same buzzwords attached to it, mm-hmm, doesn't quite achieve.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the I was rooting for Christopher Nolan to win Best Director, even though I might like, yeah, shocking. Even though, like, for their career, I might like Paul Thomas Anderson more if we sort of average out my emotions, which is admittedly impossible. But, like, just because I want him to have an Oscar, and I feel like Dunkirk is the movie where it's like, I mean, that ticking clock is just continually saying Christopher Nolan, Christopher Nolan, Christopher Nolan to you. Like, it's just so, it's so like, this is me putting my stamp on this movie so frequently that I refuse to remove this sound effect, even though it's totally incongruous with how filmmaking tends to work. And I think it would have been, like, that's the way people talk about Dunkirk and the way people are going to remember Dunkirk is that it was loud and awesome, and the man behind the loudness and the awesomeness was Christopher Nolan. And, you know, he's the most, of his generation, he's probably the most famous filmmaker, right, by name. It might be close, but I think it depends on what generation you fit James Cameron into.
It just doesn't even work that much right now.
Yeah, exactly. And most people just kind of know him as a dick, you know, who makes movies that we generally forget about eventually. But I guess people remember Titanic forever. But yeah, just, I don't know. This just feels like it would have been the perfect scenario for Christopher Nolan to win an Oscar without any sort of backlash for it. Because everybody that saw that movie was like, yeah, that makes sense. Those plane scenes were awesome, you know?
Yeah.
And it would really fall in line with the way that the Academy has awarded the award a lot over the years, and that it's, I think we've used this term on our Dunkirk podcast, it was the most directed movie. You know, it's like, like The Revenant won Best Director because it was the most directed.
Yeah. Because I definitely remember what that sunset looked like.
Yeah, exactly. That shot of Tom Hardy looking at his plane burn, you know?
Yeah. And I'll say, though, that the backlash, I mean, I think you could anticipate what the Dunkirk backlash would have been.
I think there would have been backlash if it won Best Picture, 100%. I was actively rooting against Dunkirk to win Best Picture. I was rooting for it to win Best Director and rooting for it to lose Best Picture. That was the best case scenario for me.
Okay.
Yeah. Because when Dunkirk wins Best Picture, you have a lot of people watching it. And we talked about this on the podcast, I think, that we did about it 6 months ago. That's a movie that, like, people are going to see on Netflix and just be like, well, that was okay. And they're going to be right, because when you see it on a 27-inch monitor, that movie's probably okay, you know? But when you...
was a World War II movie, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, oh, I was fuddling with the volume a lot when people were speaking. Like, I turned it up so I could hear people. But, like, when you see people that see it in a theater, and I'm not saying this is, you know, across the board. A good friend of mine that I saw it with just said, well, that was loud. You know, like, that was her review. And, but, like, the people that see it in the theater and are able to enjoy and feel like come out of it feeling like they enjoyed it, it's the bigness of it all that they appreciate. And that's why I didn't want it to win Best Picture, because it's not something that is going to hold up outside of repertory screenings, I don't think, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think, I don't know. I think Best Director is still up there. Like, it's not Best Picture, but it's Best Picture 1B. You know what I mean? Yeah. That to give it, I mean, the second most prestigious award is still saying something about the merit of the movie, right?
Yeah, but I also think, like, the I feel like we should cut this short pretty soon, like, as far as the Nolan side of things, but just because we have I have a tendency to do this with Nolan, but, like, just go on and on about him. But I feel like that even if we're talking about that Netflix situation, even when somebody watches it on Netflix, if it hasn't been awarded as a movie but has been awarded as directing, I feel like there's less people having less of a problem with it, because they can still see that again, the planes are flying around and that's cool. whereas when you're awarding it as a movie, it's just a different conversation altogether. You know?
Yeah, because if you don't know that much about movies, you can say this was the best movie of the year versus best direction. Yeah, okay, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Like, people like me care about best director, whereas out of the, you know, say 10, my 10 closest film fans, 8 of them are going to forget who won best director probably a week from now, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think I think that one of Nolan's, like, legacies, this might bother you, is going to be that the rule change about 10 Best Picture nominations, mm-hmm, is, yeah, because Dark Knight didn't make it. And if I don't know. I think that might be hilariously emblematic of his career if he were to never get Best Director or Best Picture, and they made this rule to make him, you know, the recipient of a participation trophy without ever taking the big one home, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it didn't get nominated in the year that Slumdog Millionaire won, you know? Like, that's sort of what we're dealing with, you know? Of the five movies that were nominated that year, it was Slumdog, Benjamin Button, Frost Nixon, Milk, and The Reader. Like, I think that really speaks to...
The Reader, yeah, that one's gonna fade.
Yeah, exactly. I think that really speaks to... something that has just been a long-held theory of mine about winning the Oscar is that usually it's very rarely the movie that's going to last from the year that ends up winning the Oscar. Even, you know, when I think the best movie of the year won Best Picture, which I think in my lifetime has only happened with No Country for Old Men, whereas I think that movie is legitimately my favorite of that year. There Will Be Blood, I feel like, has better legs, you know? And yeah, it's just so rare that, and it's so obvious that of 2017, Get Out is going to be the movie people remember. Like, it just, the line, like, it's just not even a question, you know? And that's why I thought it had no chance at Best Picture, because everybody knows that it's the movie of this of these nine that was going to last, you know? So it winning Best Picture would have even been weird, you know?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you is, there's... Because we timestamp it, right? Like this 2017, boom, it was whatever won Best Picture. It gets so tied up with the temporality of it. Mm-hmm. And Shape of Water, you know, it has these things that you can point to and things that we have pointed to about, you know, women and homosexuals and visible minorities. And, you know, there's some... timely issues. There are some things you can point to say this was a very 2017 movie in this respect. Dunkirk could have come out in any one of the last 60 years in a way that Get Out couldn't have, right?
I agree.
And I think Shape of Water is, even though it has some of these things that people are talking about now, it's not really a 2017 movie in a certain way, right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, and so, I mean, it couldn't have come out in 1996 just because we weren't used to the, like, or I guess 1991, maybe. It couldn't have come out then because people weren't used to genres combining in a pre-Tarantino world, you know?
Okay. Yes.
But yeah, I do agree with what you were saying. It's certainly less 2017 than Get Out, you know?
Yeah. And so I think that when people kind of talk about the best picture... being representative of the year that it won it, and something like, you know, Slumdog Millionaire you brought up, The Artist is kind of one of those ones that's just, I kind of think the same way, just in a void of time. It's just not on that spectrum.
Yeah, literally the only reason we remember that movie is because it won Best Picture. You know?
Yeah.
We would both have forgotten about it by now. Yeah.
And so I think that there's this idea that it's supposed to be the movie that touches the most timely subject versus the one that's the best movie that was made that year. And I think that's a difficult balance. And I think, I mean, also we kind of talk about the Academy like it's one mind, but it's a lot of different people voting and a lot of different people have different ideas about what was the best picture, so I don't want to get too stuck up
and
a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, and the Academy has notably had a lot of changeover in the last couple of years. Yeah,
and the last year, I think they inducted the most people they've ever inducted in one year, exactly. And try to balance things out from a demographic standpoint. And so I think that is something that we can sometimes get stuck on. And I don't think, as much as I've, you know, Shape of Water does touch on things that people might remember as being something people talked about this year, it's not the one that addresses the most or is the most on the nose about what people talked about. And I think that Get Out has to be that one. And you and I both like Get Out, but is it the job of the Academy to point to the one that is the most contemporary or the one that made a movie that is the best movie?
I don't know. I just sort of like, I guess I don't really think about it from the aspect of the Academy, because that's something I'm so far removed from. I will never have a vote in this race, you know, like I, yeah. I probably will never talk to anybody who does. I just sort of think about it in the way that in the conversations that I have a few days after the Oscars or, you know, as I was explaining about the Dunkirk thing, like, and me and our friend Jamie were talking about this on Sunday night, like talking about Dunkirk 6 months from now and how that conversation is going to go. The Netflix thing, just like, I was really concerned, like Greta Gerwig was going to win Best Director, not because I didn't want her to win. I certainly was not rooting for her, but I think the backlash to her winning Best Director for Lady Bird would have been like, it would have made me really uncomfortable. Like it would have just been like, well, it's not even a directed movie. It's a teen movie or whatever, which it is. And it's not my favorite movie, but it just immediately attaching these labels to things changes how we talk about the movies. And it's cool. It's good that somebody like Guillermo del Toro now has the I directed a Best Picture thing on his attached to his name. Like I like that he will have clout to be able to do something, even if it's only a minor level of clout. You know, like the next time he makes Shape of Water instead of 19.5 million, maybe he gets 29.5 to make it with. You know, and that's cool. It helps in some way. It helps somebody that I have faith in make, or at least some sort of interest in seeing a new movie from, make the movie that's closer. More closely aligned to who they are. But sometimes I feel like it sort of tarnishes a movie. And I could even see it with, again, on Sunday night, before Best Picture was announced, talking to somebody I saw Lady Bird with and sat next to in Lady Bird and turned to immediately after it was over and said, how did you like that? And she said that I love that. And Sunday night, as we were talking about nominations, she was like, yeah, it was good. And I was just like, what is happening? Like, I saw this movie with you. And I admittedly know that like when the credits roll, that doesn't mean your opinion is set in stone, you know?
Yeah.
Because my opinion on Lady Bird changed in the 6 hours after I saw it, you know, like I just sort of came to terms with some things about it that were just never going to speak to me and that I appreciated about them from afar eventually. But I just sort of think like something like that would have changed the conversations about specifically that movie and Greta Gerwig's career going forward. That would have made me really uncomfortable. And I think really would have turned the way people think about Greta Gerwig. And in that now people view her positively. And I think it could have turned negatively pretty quickly. And I don't know. I think it's kind of good that she didn't win. And I maybe feel similarly about Jordan Peele winning Best Director. I'm so happy he has an Oscar, but I worry that it would have turned if he had won director instead of screenplay. You know?
Something about that makes
me uncomfortable. Just the way these things change.
Something I want to ask you about, because I think that there's the one side of the coin that is I have a Best Director Oscar, so you're going to meet all these demands for me, or I'm going to make whatever I want. And then there's the other side of, I think it was the Timothée Chalamet article in The Ringer today or yesterday.
Okay, I probably didn't read it.
It was basically saying that him not winning is the best thing that could happen, and that a lot of it was comparing him to Leonardo DiCaprio, saying you could do all these great performances and not win, and all it does is drive you to work with great directors and to keep being really good at what you do and not sign a 9-picture deal with Marvel because you have that clout and you can get a huge paycheck. And yeah, just the two sides of that coin, saying there's something awesome about not having clout. There's something that pushes you to be better if you've been great all along but not recognized as such. And I don't know if you think not winning might be beneficial for any of those people. You know, the way that you talk about Ryan Coogler or Ryan Johnson and some of these young, obviously very talented directors getting snapped up and having 2 years of their life on a gigantic budget film that will get them a big paycheck and they will probably say nothing meaningful with as a result.
Yeah. So, and also just in the way that like Ryan Coogler not even getting nominated for best director for Creed, like further fuels my passion for his skill level. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Exactly.
Cause he does such a good job in that movie. And, I do take mild umbrage with you saying that there was nothing of value in Black Panther, which is I don't think is a movie you've seen. Correct me
if
I'm wrong.
No, I haven't seen Black Panther.
Okay, yeah. So most of it is a Marvel, just a standard Marvel movie, and everybody's wrong about like, oh, it's the best movie in the world. Like, no, incorrect. Most of it is a Marvel movie. Michael B. Jordan's character is legitimately like fantastic, and I was shocked that they were able to fit some of those ideas into a Marvel movie. And that's that Ryan Coogler skill level finding a way in the most highly controlled environment in Hollywood, you know, where yeah. you have to use this green screen and this camera package and all this dumb bullshit that makes our movies look like cardboard. And he's still
this shade of green.
Yeah, exactly. And he still finds a way to make that movie start and end in Oakland. You know, like that's like it's fantastic. Like the elements of that movie that are good are so good. It's just that most of it is still a Marvel movie, and you're right that somebody winning sort of continues somebody's reputation and with people like us, like how or I guess more specifically me, because you kind of like don't really vocalize like strong opinions about directors as much as I do, you know. And it was kind of why like in the group of five, why I was rooting for, to go back to the more established directors, I was rooting for Nolan over PTA, because it's not, Phantom Thread isn't PTA's best work. Like, I love Phantom Thread. I think it's very good. And you know, he's got an apology Oscar coming to him at some point for The Master, you know?
Yeah, he does.
And you know, this one would have felt like an apology Oscar to most people. I feel like, people enjoy watching this movie, but there's just something, and it certainly has some of the elements of a movie to make it worth talking about. Like there are fun elements that I'm just dancing around mentioning because I know you haven't seen it. But
it hasn't dominated conversation in a way that like There Will Be Blood has.
It is. No, that is true in that it hasn't like crossed over, but it has dominated a conversation on the internet in the same way Call Me By Your Name has, despite also not making a lot of money. You know, like the internet, like film Twitter really loved Call Me By Your Name, just like film Twitter really loved Phantom Thread. I like one of those movies way more than the other. And yeah, it just like PTA winning best director this year, I don't know, just would have been, I guess in the long run, people would only remember him having an Oscar. It's not like people remember Denzel won for Training Day specifically. They just remember that he won an Oscar, you know? And
now he can sit next to Meryl Streep whenever he wants.
Yeah, exactly. Literally every year.
Even or when she can sit next to him.
No, he can sit next to Meryl. she will break your leg like Jodie Foster. You would ever watch your mouth. But yeah, I don't know. I just think that of these five, Christopher Nolan winning would have made me the happiest. But I don't have qualms with Guillermo del Toro having an Oscar. And I just, again, like talking about The Shape of Water in the last 2 days has just been really fascinating, as opposed to the month before when I was having conversations about it, in that like just the immediately people are sort of like more warily expressing their opinions. Like they can't say that they loved it, you know, like there's something about it where people talking about it, where people are like, yeah, of course the Academy loves movies about movies. I'm like, it's not a movie about movies, you know? Like, and then it just gets me like passionate about a movie that I wasn't super passionate about, but now I feel like it's being wronged because it won an award. I don't know. It's just it's like this weird combination of things that happens every year and I will never figure out, but it just toys with my emotions in some way, just because it's the only time of the year when it seems like everybody talks about film for a couple days. And something that I think was just, you know, I was in my office talking about it with the guy I share an office with, and he was just like, yeah, it was fine, yada, 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 whereas I feel like he would have felt more positively about it. And then I was talking to the guy who cuts my hair, and he was like, yeah, I saw it, and I thought it was good, but it wasn't like a best picture. You know, like everybody has to say their opinion, but it wasn't best picture, you know? And And that's just something that will always exist. It will always be unfair in some capacity, but over time, that the second half of that sentence does not matter, because most Best Picture winners are not remembered. Most, you know, I do this pretty frequently. Like every year or something, somebody will around Oscars, I'll like, we'll start talking about past Best Picture winners, and then like in my head, I start going back and seeing how far I can get back in time without incorrectly stating a Best Picture winner, and I can't get very far. You know, like it's 10 years tops. And even for me, that's something I should be able to remember. And going back to talking to my barber about this movie, he's like, yeah, I thought it was okay, but it wasn't Best Picture. And then we're talking about movies more. And, you know, he's about my age and all these things. And he's like, yeah, it was the only Best Picture nominee I saw. And then about 5 seconds passed. And then I realized that, oh, Get Out was nominated for Best Picture. And like, I was like, wait, you didn't see Get Out? And I think that, and then he was like, I know, I should see that movie. And I think that is the thing that will carry on with time, is the realization of somebody not seeing a movie and then you being emotionally invested in it, in them seeing that movie, like, immediately. Like, that was a reactionary thing. That wasn't me thinking, oh, for the good of society, this gentleman has to see Get Out. Otherwise, I will take my hair elsewhere. Good day. It was just sort of like, it's a gut reaction, you know? It's like, oh, you have to see this. And Get Out's definitely that movie for this year. And I know I wasn't, like, I talked about this on our Moonlight podcast, but, like, Moonlight was an outlier as in winning Best Picture, because if that wasn't the best movie of the year, it was definitely close and has, like, it's just put together in a way that most Best Pictures are not. It's just it's very inventive, stylistically, for reasons that we broke down. And that's just, and I think over time, Moonlight will be the movie remembered from that year. I think it will always be hand in hand with La La Land, and that's unfortunate, but so it goes. And I don't know. I just think the biggest compliment a movie can have is the bug-eyed, like, oh, you haven't seen Get Out, you know, like, and and The Shape of Water just doesn't have that, but it does have a lot of positive things. And the good thing is Jordan Peele won a screenplay Oscar. So like, it's kind of the best of both worlds, you know, and the movie that I think will last got awarded in not the biggest way, because maybe if it had gotten awarded in the biggest way, it wouldn't have lasted as well, you know? And so I think like this year, if it was kind of a boring Oscars because most people that were expected to win won, I don't know. I think it's going to work out in the long run for everybody, basically. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to watch Get Out and then check back next week when we'll be talking about something else.